this edition of the Hagmann Report. You know, with all the news with respect to Russia today, we have a very, very interesting guest coming up. Her name is Amy Knight. She's written a book called Orders to Kill. And it's some historical background about Putin, specifically Putin, and dozens of journalists who were, and political opponents as well, who were really taken out by the Putin regime. And it's interesting how we in the West look at Putin. Some put him up on a pedestal, some lionize him, it's just an amazing reaction and a series of reactions, and especially now with all of this Russian entanglement and such. So we're going to be talking with Amy Knight shortly. It amazes me, by the way, that, I get taken to task for, using an improper or using a phrase, for conveying my anger. Is that really the people that are listening, when I'm angry, and I say this marginally, not a cuss word, but just an off-color language. My question is that what really makes you angry? Is that really what where you want to focus? And when we talk about 58 dead and no answers, is that really what upsets you? That's my question to you. And if it is, fair enough. Okay, we know your standards are. So, but okay. Now a couple of things as well. Tucker Carlson last night, and that was a great clip by Tucker Carlson that you played during your afternoon show. And I think 8 minutes of, I think what was that, 7 or 8 minutes of the Jesus Campos disappearance and, going to Mexico and coming back. And that was fun by Tucker Carlson.
Yeah, and he asked about the police behavior.
Yep.
He asked why basic questions were not being answered. He or his somebody from his show called the sheriff's department and asked what qualifications you needed to be a security guard at a Las Vegas casino. And they were met with Jesus Campos as a victim. We're not answering your question. Very telling.
Yeah.
When you can't even get basic information that isn't even, you're not even asking, did this happen? Did that happen? You're asking, what qualifications would you need to perform this job?
Right.
And you're still being told no.
But by the way, I did miss my morning show. I had to take today off because I was doing interviews with Keith Hansen in New England. So I'll be back tomorrow for those interested, 9 a.m. Eastern time on the Global Star Radio Network as well as BTR. But with us now is an incredible author, the author of Orders to Kill, Amy Knight. She is perhaps one of the foremost experts on all things Putin, all things Russia, in Orders to Kill, the Putin Regime and Political Murder. That's the name of the book. The KGB scholar, and she is a KGB scholar, ties the many victims together to expose a campaign of political murder during Putin's reign that even includes terrorist attacks, such as, now listen to this, the Boston bombing, Boston Marathon bombing. In Russia, shall I say, is no stranger to political murder. And you go back in history, the czars and the Soviets before him. Putin has maintained a grip on power through coercion, through intimidation. I think many people in the West don't really understand that fact. And again, they like to put him up on a pedestal. And they don't see what Amy Knight has uncovered. And I think that's really important. So we're going to have a discussion about really what the Putin regime is really like, about the smoking guns, even quite literally, and Putin and such, with Amy Knight. She's a respected scholar, again, the author of this book, which we are so thankful to have.
Yeah.
It's
so
an incredible
interesting
read. Orders to Kill. Amy Knight, Ms. Knight, welcome to the Hagmann Report.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for your gift of time, and we really appreciate it. This is a fascinating book. I have to start out by prefacing my first question with the fact that I was intrigued by the Soviet Russia before the fall, and intrigued by their infiltration the communist infiltration into the United States, among other things. So that set the stage for this book. And when I read this book, I was amazed at what you uncovered and what you found. What would people be surprised? And this is kind of an off script question, but what would be the one thing people would be amazed to find out that you've uncovered in your book here? If I could start off with that question.
Well, I should say that basically I provide quite a bit of circumstantial evidence pointing to the fact that several of the murders of Putin's critics, journalists, politicians, these murders can be tied to the Kremlin. Now, I say very clearly in my book that there is no smoking gun, because Mr. Putin and his allies in the Kremlin would not be so stupid as to leave that kind of a trace. But I think if you read my book, you'll see by the numerous cases that I discuss that, in fact, there is so much circumstantial evidence that it's really, really hard not to conclude the complicity of the Kremlin.
You make an extremely good case. Circumstantial evidence, in my view, is perhaps the most difficult evidence to manufacture. And I think in totality, as I went through your book, it was pretty clear, you know, in terms of the enemies, their actions, and then their ultimate fate. There's some common ground they share. How many reporters, how many political opponents since Putin assumed his reign of power, do you think?
Well, you know, people ask me that all the time, and it's very difficult to put a number on that, because it's important to note that even in the 90s, under Yeltsin, there was a lot of violence, mafia-related violence, local politicians and journalists and so on and so forth. So there have been a lot of murders, but the number that I feel probably indicate that they were ordered by the Kremlin are, you know, maybe a dozen or so, and these are the most important people, and I talk about them in my book. You've probably heard of Alexander Litvinenko.
Oh, yeah.
He was the former KGB FSB officer who defected from Russia in 2000, and he went to London and got asylum there. He was poisoned by polonium-210, a very lethal radioactive poison in London. And that case actually is interesting because, in fact, the British High Court, after several years and a lot of persistence on the part of Litvinenko's widow, to whom I dedicate my book, by the way, they decided to have a real investigation and an in-depth inquiry into Litvinenko's death. And they actually did prove that these two men hired by the FSB were the ones who administered this poison to Litvinenko. So they were tied directly to the Kremlin. Now, the high court judge, I think for diplomatic reasons or whatever, he only said probably Putin ordered these crimes. Again, there wasn't a smoking gun, but it was about as close as you could get, because interestingly enough, first of all, Russia, these men, after they administered the poison, it was through tea. Litvinenko drank tea with them in the Millennium Hotel, in the Pine Bar of the Millennium Hotel. And it took him about 23 days before he died. And they didn't know what the cause was until the very last day, when they finally got all these experts in. He'd been in the hospital, and they figured it out that it was polonium. Meanwhile, these two killers hired by the FSB had gone back to Russia. And they were, the British government asked to have them extradited. The Russian government refused. Not only that, President Putin gave one of the men, Andrei Lugovoy, a medal, a high honor, and Lugovoy was made a member of parliament. So, and this with the full knowledge that these men had carried out the murder. So that just kind of, I'm citing that case first because that, in you know, in most people's opinions, that was pretty well proven. I mean, a huge amount of evidence pointing to the Kremlin.
Indeed. And we covered that on our program as well, but not to the degree and depth that you did, which is phenomenal.
And Amy, I want to ask you this before we go any further, especially after the election. For some reason, many Americans believe that Putin is a strong moral leader and that he is an advocate for Christianity and Christians in Russia. Even adding on to what you just said, how is this a misconception?
Well, that's an interesting question because, you know, President Putin, very quickly, once he became president in 2000, he portrayed himself as someone who was religious. And the Kremlin has used the church as a kind of a propaganda mechanism to give them more legitimacy. And, you know, I personally have no idea what Putin's personal beliefs are, but he certainly, you know, has sort of kowtowed to the Russian Orthodox Church. And you know, probably quite a few people in Russia believe that that Putin and the Kremlin, you know, are committed to the Russian Orthodoxy. But I judging from the way Putin behaves, I think it's highly unlikely that he really is a Christian.
Yeah, if you're, you know, the circumstantial cases or the circumstantial evidence that are reflected in the cases in your book, it's hard to balance that Christianity belief, the ideology of being a Christian, with the possibility of ordering the murder of your political opponents.
Well, it's interesting only because you see, in the Soviet period, communism was the ideology. And there was no you know, the churches were closed. The leadership made no pretense of being religious because they were communists, and the communists were the religion. So it's just interesting. There was kind of a gap, an ideological, a sort of a belief gap, once the Soviet Union collapsed and we no longer had communism. So one of the, you know, one area that has been kind of used is the Russian Orthodox Church.
Let me ask you what you just said there, because I've been doing a lot of studying of research. In fact, Diana West, I don't know, the author, American Betrayal, and during the Soviet era in the 30s and 40s and such. Did communism end in your view, or is it, I mean, because you said, you know, with the ending of communism, I believe, and I'm paraphrasing here, did it really end, or did it kind of change colors or change faces a little bit?
Well, again, that's a good question. Actually, I don't believe that the members of the Politburo in the post-Stalin period were even that fervent in their belief of communism. It was used more to, you know, generate loyalty and feelings of patriotism to the regime. Yes, they were communists in the sense that they didn't believe in private property and private enterprise. But, so, you know, they had a socialist or a communist system, but as far as their actual belief in communism, you know, I'm talking about the real true communism of Lenin, where, you know, the proletariat was going to rule. This kind of fell by the wayside. Now, in the post-Soviet period, there is a communist party in Russia, and they, you know, they get elected to parliament, but it's not very strong. and, okay. and it doesn't have much of a following. So I would say that communism is pretty well defunct now in Russia.
The old style, old guard communism, I suppose, is what we're. Yeah, and I could. I love this conversation because I really. There's just so much. To really learn, and you cover so much in your book, Orders to Kill. That was a great, is a great book. It's one of my favorite reads in this subject area. So getting back to Putin, how does he get away with murdering his opponents, assuming that you're making the case for that, which you are, and I believe that. How does he get away with murdering his opponents, with impunity?
He gets away with it because he controls all of the agencies, the judicial and the legal system and the police and the security services are all under his direct control. When he became president, he basically installed his former KGB colleagues into leading positions in the government, and particularly in the security and the police and the judicial organs. And there, so these people take their orders from Putin, and they're, you know, all the investigations are controlled by them. So, and interestingly enough, there's nothing like a parliamentary oversight over the police and the security services. So they don't have to answer to anyone. So if they're investigating a murder, they usually pretty quickly come up with the trigger man, somebody who has actually, you know, pulled the trigger. But then when it comes to investigating who is behind the plot, who is the mastermind, we call it the zakazchik in Russian, that person is never found. So it's basically because the Russian system of justice is a sham. I mean, they don't have, when it's any case that's important to the Kremlin, be it economic or political or whatever, there is no justice at all. It's all controlled at the top.
Amy, I want to ask you a question, because in reading your book, Orders to Kill, folks, this is the book, it's a great read. I did not know this history. What happened in September of 1999 in Russia, and how did that help propel Vladimir Putin to the presidency?
Well, in September 99, there were four bombings in different apartments in Russia. And it just came, I think there were over 300 people who were killed. These buildings just crumbled. It was a huge, huge shock. I and others have called it the Russians' version of 9/11, because all these innocent people were suddenly dead. Well, Mr. Putin at the time was prime minister, and Yeltsin was preparing himself to step down because he couldn't stay in power any longer. He was a drunk. He was in bad health. He basically was completely ineffectual as a leader, and they had to find somebody else to take his place. So Putin's circle, it's called sometimes the family around Putin, or around Yeltsin, decided on Mr. Putin. He at that time was head of the FSB, the security services. And I think there's quite a bit of evidence that they felt by anointing Putin as Yeltsin's successor, he would make sure that Yeltsin and his family wouldn't be subjected to any corruption charges, that they'd be protected after Yeltsin stepped down, which is what happened. But nobody really had ever heard of Mr. Putin. So the bombings, what they did was, first of all, it shocked the whole country. It was an outrage. And the leadership blamed it on Chechens. The Chechens who were in the Republic of Chechnya, who were separatists and had carried out some terrorist attacks. So this was the justification, these bombings, for the Russian military to launch their second war in Chechnya. and they marched in and basically, well, they invaded the whole country, inflicted huge casualties. It was a terrible, terrible bloodbath. But Mr. Putin sort of came forth as this man who appealed to the Russians' patriotism and their nationalism. And he said, we're going to get these Chechens. We're going to wipe them out in their outhouses, is what he said. And this gave him a huge amount of credibility because suddenly he was the leader who was protecting them. Now, back to the evidence, whether, you know, whether it was the FSB that was actually behind the bombings. This is a fairly complicated case, and I am by no means the only one to suggest that the FSB was involved. There have been quite a few investigative reports by Russian journalists and Western journalists that have pretty much shown that the FSB basically got these people to go in and commit these, carry out these bombings, but they were the ones who planned it so that Putin would somehow gain this popularity, if you will, among the Russian people.
That's all right. Go ahead. Yeah,
no,
I didn't want to talk over you. Sorry about that. We go ahead.
That's very interesting. And I'm 34 years old, and I studied a lot of history. But you know, reading about these bombings, this is the first time that I've actually heard about them. And the what you talk about in the book about how through the politics they would separate through the ethnicities and play one against the other, and we've seen that again, you know, just in recent years in Russia, and with this polarization of the media today that we see, you know, Russia, and Putin being and Putin and Trump, Putin and Clinton, that it has inserted itself into American politics. I want to ask you this: do you believe that the Russian agenda or the agenda of Putin is that to influence American politics?
Well, I do believe that the Russians certainly had their views. If we're talking about American politics, let's go straight to the question of the presidential elections. I think it's pretty clear that Putin and his colleagues did not like Obama, and they didn't like Hillary Clinton. And so they, for a number of reasons, but they, I think, felt that Mr. Trump, now President Trump, would be a better candidate who might be more favorably inclined to cooperating with the Kremlin. And so I think they did. Well, we know now, of course, that they did interfere in our elections by, you know, all the ads that they bought on Facebook, by the hacking of the Democratic National Committee, and Twitter and this and that. So I think, yes, they did try to influence our presidential campaign. And I think that they were hoping and were pleased that Mr. Trump was elected president. Now, I don't think that the Kremlin anticipated that their involvement would emerge so clearly, and I think it's caused them a lot of headache, because I think what they really wanted to do was to have this be a covert effort. And I think right now, even though they still, the Kremlin still seems favorable towards the Trump administration, I think actually the Trump administration is still a question mark for them, because they don't really know what kind of a policy Mr. Trump, President Trump is going to pursue. It's still early days. Hmm. So I think, you know, did they have a plan? I think it was sort of a crapshoot for the Kremlin, because they really didn't know what they were going to get with President Trump.
I appreciate that analysis, by the way. The candor of your analysis, given the fact that, however, although I might register an objection with you, the Facebook ads, and correct me if I'm wrong, although there was a lot of money spent, I think only $6,500, the investigation revealed only about $6,500 went to the Facebook side of electioneering, unless I'm wrong. But having said that, your analysis, your measured analysis of this is very interesting nonetheless, indeed.
And Amy, I wanted to get your insight onto what Putin's possible agenda was in America and in American politics, because I wanted to ask you about the military side of things with the Putin's feels threatened by the encroachment of NATO. Do you?
Oh yeah.
And the second part of that question was going to be: do you think the influence of American politics is a preposition for a possible war or conflict with America?
Between Russia and the United States?
Yes.
Well, to answer your first question, it's very interesting. I don't know if either of you saw this very long 4-hour interview that Oliver Stone did with Vladimir Putin. It came out this summer, actually, and he was really the only journalist that's gotten such exclusive access to Vladimir Putin. And it really was struck me. I wouldn't say surprised, but it was very interesting. Time and time again, Putin talked to Oliver Stone about NATO and how they were Russia's enemy and how they were trying to undermine Russian politics and society. And you know, I believe Mr. Putin. I think he and his colleagues, because we're not just talking about one man, we're talking about a group of men, I think that they genuinely do feel threatened by NATO. I don't think they feel like NATO is going to march in militarily to Russia by any means, but I think they feel that NATO is trying, and the West in general, Western governments, NGOs and so forth, are trying to undermine the Russian system of government. So they are, you know, genuinely nervous about NATO. And that was one of the things they were hoping that President Trump, and I think to a certain sense that hope has been realized. President Trump is not, you know, he went over to NATO and he kind of voiced a lack of enthusiasm about the NATO alliance and questioned it. And of course, this is something that, would naturally please the Kremlin, because this they view as the greatest threat that they're facing. But I don't think we're talking, I think that, Russia is not ruled by irrational men. And I don't think we're really talking about any military involvement on the part of either the West or Russia at this point. Of course, they do have their military still in eastern Ukraine. And it would be nice if they would withdraw those troops, but I don't see that happening for a while.
Okay, and I know we're getting kind of away from the political murders and the regime of Putin, but the geopolitical situation in the world today. This is the last question I'll ask you about this. Where would Russia fall if there's a conflict? We see them backing up the Syrian government. We also see them backing up Iran. If there was a World War III type scenario, would Russia be on the side of the U.S. geopolitically and militarily?
Oh, gee. Well, that's a hard one. I mean, I don't know what kind of a military involvement you're talking about. I think Russia likes to sort of stir up trouble. Putin and the Kremlin like to kind of, it's very important to Putin that he's a global player and that he has influence. I don't think that the Kremlin would welcome any kind of increased military conflict, even in Syria, for example. I don't think they want military involvement. I think they like to undermine regimes that they are nervous about. They like to undermine them politically and economically. But I, so it's very difficult for me to imagine, I mean, what would happen with Iran, for example. Yes, you're right that Russia is not particularly on our side with Iran. But again, you know, they have a lot of their own concerns about the Middle East. You know, they, as I mentioned, they do have their own terrorist problem. And they've got a lot of people from the North Caucasus in Syria. And so, you know, I don't think that they want to get things to the point of any kind of real military conflict.
And I have a tendency to agree with that. They want to stir up trouble globally, but they've got national, Putin at least has got nationalist interest primary, I suppose. Is that a good way to put it?
Yes.
But, you know, like in the Ukraine, it seems that the MO is the same as what you talk about in your book, is how he is able to get away with these murders and assassinations and deaths without ever being directly related to him or anything actually, you know, getting back to him. It's all circumstantial, as you say, and it's interesting to see how the different stances on Russia and the geopolitical world come out. But getting back to your book, the communist system of Russia, the Soviet Russia that fell, and the KGB, Putin, has he just uses the same tactics, only wraps them up in a different ideology. Is that a fair statement?
The same tactics as
the communist KGB style of government.
Well, there are some differences. First of all, people can engage in private enterprise. So, you know, they've got, they have much more economic freedom. And people can leave the country whenever they want and travel freely. And compared with what, existed under Brezhnev, let's not talk, things loosened up considerably under Gorbachev, but, compared with the Brezhnev and the Khrushchev period, of course, there's a lot more freedom of expression. I mean, you didn't see the kind of demonstrations that you see in Russia now during the Soviet period, except at the very end when the Soviet Union collapsed. So in that regard, things are very different. The only thing that I would say is there's a distinct parallel is that in Russia, you don't really have any kind of free elections, because the state controls the television, and that's where a lot of people get their news, is from state-controlled television, so they get all that propaganda. They don't really get a balanced view of anything. And people who appear on the ballots in these elections, be it to the parliament or now we're going to have the presidential election in March, they don't have a choice. There are no alternatives, really. So it's usually the United Russia Party. I mean, there were elections in September, and we did see a few independents winning some of the local elections. But basically, we don't have fair, they do not have fair, free elections in Russia at all.
Right. And I think that's important for us, we in the West, to understand so many misconceptions. Our guest is Amy Knight. She's the author of Orders to Kill. It's a tremendous book, folks. If you want to know the real nitty gritty from Amy Knight, who earned her PhD degree in Russian politics at the London School of Economics, Political Science, back in 1977, she's taught a number of locations in the United States and Canada. And of course, she's the author of 5 books. This is one of them. And perhaps one of the most engaging, at least in my view, in terms of the Putin regime and what it's all about. And she's appeared on so many news channels. Again, our guest, Amy Knight, you can get her book. In fact, go to our show description, and that'll take you right to Amy Knight, amyknight.org. And that for the book. And, of course, We're so glad to have her.
And also, I want to give a special thanks to Bill McIntosh.
And Chuck Monroe, too.
Yeah, for providing us as guests. Ocaso Media, Bill McIntosh, thank you so much, as always.
Absolutely. Ms. Knight, who's next? Who's next on Putin's hit list, in your estimation?
Well, I mean, you know, I hate to even say anything like that, because it would really be horrible if we had another act of violence. But just this week, there was a very, very shocking stabbing of a young woman, 32 years old, who is the deputy editor of a radio show, a program called Echo of Moscow. And it's Russia's main independent radio. They have a website too with blogs and so forth. It's really the most important news outlet in Russia. And, a man came in and got up to, this young woman, Tanya Felgengauer, and stabbed her in the throat. And she was in pretty serious condition. She had to be operated on. I have read now that she's stable. I don't know, you know, what damage was done to her, you know, her vocal cords or whatever, but it was really, really shocking. And the thing is that this man who did this, who stabbed her, they caught him right away, and he's in police custody. Turns out he was kind of crazy. He'd been kind of fantasizing about Tanya Felgengauer, and he'd written some things on his blog about her. So he was definitely mentally, you know, crazy guy. But then the question was, how did he know that she was going to be there? She didn't have a show at that time. He had a map with him of the building. And some of the people who work with Tanya have suggested that in fact, that he was put up to do this. Now, why would that happen? Well, she is an outspoken critic of Vladimir Putin. And in fact, she had just been on a Russian television program a couple of weeks ago. They talked about the West trying to undermine Russia and the evil West, and they mentioned her as being the recipient of funds from the West and being, you know, kind of in cahoots with West. So, you know, people are saying, gosh, this came on so soon after that. So, again, we have a situation of people just wondering. But I can tell you one thing. It intimidates Russian journalists and politicians when something like this happens. And just a month ago, one of the best-known journalists in Russia, Yulia Latunina, fled Russia because her car had been bombed, her house had been gassed, and she was terrified for her life. So, you know, anybody who stays there faces danger. I've written a few articles recently about Alexei Navalny, who is an anti-corruption crusader, and he's running for the presidency. He has been told that he will not be allowed on the ballot because he has two felony charges against him. They were bogus charges, but nonetheless, the Russian government has said that he can't run. He has ignored this, and he has gone all over the country campaigning, and he has a huge following, particularly among the young people. And he, you know, he's nationally known. He's very articulate, charismatic, handsome, and he, in addition, he's made himself a real enemy of the Kremlin because he has produced with his staff several films, documentary exposés about the Putin leadership in which he has demonstrated how corrupt these people are. So if you were going to ask me, someone who I feel really, you know, is probably under threat, it would be Alexei Navalny. And he has insisted that he won't leave Russia. He did say a few months ago that he thinks he has a 50-50 chance of being killed. But, you know, I think we can just all hope and pray that the Kremlin wouldn't do this.
You know, and again, our guest is Amy Knight, the author of Orders to Kill. It's a tremendous book. And our thanks go out to Bill McIntosh of Casa Media and Mr. Chuck Monroe from Gold Dust PR firm. But and you're so gracious with your time and sharing your knowledge. I want to thank you so much. I've got to ask you, though. It was a couple of years ago. It was November 2015. In Washington, D.C., Mikhail Lesin.
Mikhail Lesin, yeah.
That's who it was. Okay, yes. Seemingly took a fall, and it was attributed initially to an accidental fall. However, and we heard this at the time, that this was something more political. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I haven't, to be honest, I haven't followed it too closely. I know that initially, the police and probably the FBI was involved initially as well. I'm quite sure because, you know, he was a foreigner and I should say that, Mr. Lesin had, formerly been the head of Gazprom Media and he was part of Putin's inner circle. And he has a son who lives in California. I believe he's a filmmaker. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, back to Mr. Lesin. He was a very heavy drinker. And that was, you know, that was pretty much a fact. And so the initial report was he went back to his hotel room and had one fall on the way to his hotel room. Anyway, he was pretty battered up. But it was attributed to him being drunk. Then only later, anonymous FBI sources have started to let it be known and it was picked up by journalists that in fact they are considering this death to be, suspicious. But I don't know where that investigation is going. I don't know, in particular what would have caused him to be, you know, why someone would want to kill him. Except, you know, there's always some intrigue when it comes to Russians, particularly at that level. And, you know, perhaps he was giving information to American authorities and the Russians didn't like it. There could be a number of reasons, but you're absolutely right. There's still a question mark about that death.
So that would tell me he's got reach in America in particular, as well as other Western countries, but think about the reach.
And the investigation first said that it was, accidental.
Yeah,
and then
a drunken fall, no less.
Yeah, then they amended that.
Yeah.
Death, and then they said that it was with acute ethanol intoxication as a contributory cause of death. But that's very interesting to see, and I remember that happening. It was a big deal.
Yeah, it certainly was. Now, can we get in, if you don't mind, because this I find fascinating. The Boston Marathon bombings, I mentioned that prior to coming on in the introduction. What role did Putin play, if any, in the Boston Marathon bombings? And I think this is kind of fascinating.
Yes, well, actually, I'm one of the few people that's gotten into this issue. And perhaps I go out on a limb, but what I really do in that section of the book is I lay out the evidence. And, I mean, it's up to the reader to draw their own conclusions. And I don't pretend to... Let's put it this way. I raise questions that I think are very important to raise. So I'll just start out by saying that by the time of the Boston bombings, the Russians really had their own terrorism problems. I've mentioned that in the North Caucasus, there are there's a strong insurgent movement. And the North Caucasians, not all of them, of course, but a lot of them are very anti-Moscow. And so the Kremlin had, you know, has been having to deal with these terrorist attacks. They were hosting the Sochi Olympics, and people were starting to say, gee, is it going to be safe? You know, I mean, Sochi's pretty close to the North Caucasus, and this is a problem. So, and the Kremlin always kind of wanted to justify its harsh treatment of the Chechens by saying that they're terrorists, and you know, and saying, you know, you have to understand that we all share this global problem with terrorism. So they were always insisting that it wasn't, you know, that it wasn't about Chechen separatism, that, you know, that they were global terrorists. So the Tsarnaev brothers, as you know, are, the father was from Chechnya, and they came from, the family came from Dagestan in the North Caucasus, and they were living in Boston. And Tamerlane, the older brother, the one who was run over by the younger brother, Dzhokhar, he was the one who became very radicalized. And at some point, the FSB alerted the FBI and the CIA that they thought that Tamerlane might be a bit of a concern. Now, it's interesting that they were even following Tamerlane Tsarnaev, because he'd been living in Boston for a number of years. And the FSB had phone conversations, and, you know, they were following him, sort of. Anyway, the FBI checked it out. They interviewed Tamerlane. They interviewed the Tsarnaev family, and they didn't find anything particularly suspicious. And that was kind of that. Well, then Tamerlane decided to go back to Russia, and he went to the North Caucasus. Maybe people don't realize, but they are Chechnya and Dagestan are part of Russia. And so Tamerlane went back in January of 2012, and he slipped through the cracks. The FBI and the Homeland Security didn't know that he left, and they didn't know that he came back. He stayed in Russia for 6 months. So in order to even be allowed to come in the country, the Russians would have interviewed him. They would have asked him why he was coming, what he was up to, and they would have followed him very, very carefully. I'm not the only one to say this. So Tamerlane went down to Dagestan, and he got involved with the radicals down there. And he came back very radicalized, and he had a global kind of a jihad idea after he spent the 6 months in Russia. The Russians never informed either the FBI or the CIA about this six-month trip that Tamerlane made. So I just raised the possibility that it certainly suited their purposes to have a Chechen or a part Chechen, two brothers, commit this terrorist attack. Putin, you know, called up Obama right away and said, now, you know, we're on your side and we all share this global terrorism problem. And it you know, the Russians made, it was kind of a propaganda coup for them that they were able to say, yes, now the Americans have their problem with terrorism. So, you know, I don't know if we'll ever know the answer, but I think it is, it raised red flags for some people that the Russians never even reported to the FBI that Tamerlane had spent 6 months in their country.
Hmm. Okay. And all of this, it's fascinating. And it's interesting how all of these, well, especially the Boston Marathon bombing, how you just explained that, and how that kind of fits in the geopolitical arena. I don't want to belabor the point, but it's fascinating the points you bring up, the case you lay out, and as you've done throughout your book, Orders to Kill. Very fascinating. And by the way, our guest is Amy Knight. She's the author of 5 books. All 5 are great. One of my favorite, I got to tell you, the KGB police and politics in the Soviet Union. Was it your first book that you wrote?
Yes, it was.
Okay. For some reason, I just kind of like that, like that book, drawn to that book. And this is kind of a softball question out there, but what was your favorite book to write? Because this had to be very difficult to write, this last book. Very time consuming, we were very involved and research heavy. What was your favorite book? I'm just curious. Out of the books you've read.
Well, my favorite book to write was a book called Who Killed Kirov? The Kremlin's Greatest Mystery. And I enjoyed writing it. It's the story of the murder of Sergei Kirov, who was at the time in 1934, he was the head of the Leningrad party apparatus. And he was shot while he was in his office, and he was shot by a crazy guy. And people for years had thought that Stalin had planned this, and that it was actually at that time it was called the NKVD. The security police had been behind this murder. And the Russians and the Soviets, too, they had commissions. They were always, it was kind of like the murder of Kennedy. I mean, you know, it was one of these cases that nobody could ever figure out. And I really enjoyed, I've been very fascinated with the Stalin period. And for me, it was interesting because I was able to go to Leningrad/St. Petersburg and do research and talk to people. And I also could use all the archival material. So I wasn't keeping up. When I write books about more current politics, I'm kind of keeping up with everything that happens. And for me, it's very rewarding to write a historical book so I can really sit back and delve into it and, you know, look at things in a different perspective. But I enjoyed writing that because I'm just fascinated with the Stalin period.
And I kind of thought so, as well as it's a great murder mystery as well. But well, thank you for entertaining that question, as academic as that might have been. Authors with multiple books, I always like to ask that question because they always have a favorite, and so that tells me a little bit about that. We only have a couple minutes left. Anything that we haven't covered that you feel that we should cover with respect to your book, Orders to Kill? Anything at all?
Well, you know, I think some people say, well, so what do you do about this? I mean, okay, so let's say, you know, Putin is a murderer. You know, what are we supposed to do about it? And the answer to that question is, I mean, there isn't really very much that Western governments can do because, I mean, we're dealing with Vladimir Putin, who is entrenched in power, and he's very likely going to win the presidential elections in March, even if Alexei Navalny, I mean, there'll probably be a lot of protests and so on and so forth, but, you know, Putin may be around for a long time. I think that just calling attention to the fact that we know this is going on, just as the British government really, you know, finally and reluctantly called attention to the murder of Litvinenko, I think it's important because, first of all, it does, you know, send some sort of a message to the Kremlin that, you know, that we know that we're not deluded. But secondly, I think it's important for human rights groups and the courageous journalists and politicians in Russia who are critical of the regime. I think it's important that we acknowledge the injustice that has been committed by these murders and, you know, and honor these people. When something like that happens, like, for example, the most recent, you know, the murder of Boris Nemtsov. I mean, that, of course, it got a huge amount of international attention because Nemtsov was a very important, politician and, you know, very admired, and he'd come to the United States and, testified before he met with Congress and so on and so forth. I think just the recognition that these things are happening and bringing it out in the open is just a very important thing to do, because, you know, down the line, when hopefully we do see Mr. Putin leave and a more democratic government come to power in Russia, you know, it's important that this history be recognized.
Very well said. KGB expert and just a fascinating researcher, author, Amy Knight, and she's appeared on all of the major networks, and of course rave reviews of her book, Orders to Kill. Count me in on that too, as far as the reviews are concerned. Ms. Knight, thank you so very much for your gracious gift of time tonight. It's just been fascinating.
And thank you for having me.
It's been our pleasure. And please come back again and provide us updates, your analysis on KGB history and current events. The invitation's open.
I'm happy to.
All right. Thank you so very much. And our thanks go out to Bill McIntosh and, of course, Chuck Monroe, both of them, and John for arranging this interview. What a gracious lady. What a knowledgeable lady. And if you really want to understand the KGB, that's the book, Orders to Kill, Putin, Understand the Mind of Putin. She does a great job in assembling the various murders. Political murders, I guess that's what we call it, right, Joe? Political murders, that's it.
Political murders.
Yeah.
Murders
yeah.
of political opposition and dissidents.
All right. Folks, thanks so much for joining us. We're coming back. You're going to want to stay for the next hour. And we're not going to tell you who is coming. You're going to want to stay. I'll be right back.
Just what kind of thriller predicts the future? In 3 days in the Belly of the Beast, Daniel Holdings wrote about the God Particle before CERN actually discovered the God Particle. In As the Darkness Falls, Daniel wrote about an Islamist terrorist confederacy that rose up out of Syria and declared a caliphate 3 years before ISIS was ever heard of. In his newest novel, Between the Veil, Daniel talks about a space between dimensions where supernatural beings can walk. He says that these novels are a warning from the Creator to his creation. Will war come to America? Will the world's economies collapse? Are we looking at increased earthquakes and volcanic activity? Will the United States fall into civil war? You can find all of Daniel's work at his website, danielholdings.com. That's danielholdings.com. All of these things and more are talked about in Daniel's books. To find out what's coming next, go to danielholdings.com.
Worldwide demand is making coconuts one of the highest yielding cash crops available today. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and many high net worth individuals have invested billions of dollars into coconuts for strong growth and solid long-term income. Yields could be as high as 18% or more per year. Capital appreciation and exceptional income for up to 60 long years would be an absolutely brilliant investment to pass on to future generations. Diversify wisely with direct ownership of fully managed coconuts on prime farmland close to the beautiful Costa Rican border. For more information, qualified accredited investors should go to profitsincoconuts.com or phone 855-888-6288. That's 855-888-6288. This announcement does not constitute an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offer made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288 or visit profitsincoconuts.com. Profitsincoconuts.com.
You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes a secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.